This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, and welcome to Teacher Talk Radio. My name is David Brown, and this is my monthly Late Night Friday program. Tonight, I'm really delighted to be speaking to Josh Pregari on diversity in teaching and how history can inspire children from minority backgrounds. Hopefully, we'll also be talking about the importance of widening the curriculum in history and hopefully much, much more.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Friday night, so I'm hoping that you're relaxed. Thanks for joining us. I can see a few people out there, which I really appreciate. I'm sure it's been a hard week. If it's anything like me, you might be extremely worried at this stage about your students and the GCSEs and A-level, which is pretty much what my week's all been about. So remember, if you're listening to us live and like to join us, to enter the live studio, to post a question in the chat for Josh to answer, or you want to call in and speak to us, then please download the Podbean app. Visit ttradio.org and click Listen Live on the homepage, and this will take you directly to the show. There you can post comments and questions. During our conversation. If you'd like to call in, you can do this by touching the icon at the top of the screen on your phone app. Call this and I'll be able to connect to you. So just thinking about the show, there's been an incredible amount of discussion, I think, in the last few years about widening the history curriculum. Although I say few years, it's probably gone back, maybe 20 years, about making the history curriculum more accessible in terms of interest and relevance for children, minority backgrounds, and that history teaching encompasses as wide a scope as possible in terms of the history experiences of what up to this point has been largely minimized or ignored stories outside of the usual European or English-focused approach. However, and I know this from my experience, it can be difficult as a teacher to know where to start. What does decolonization of the curriculum actually mean? What are the practicalities of doing this? How does it actually work, particularly given the constraints at GCSE and A-level, where we're under pressure to ensure good results for our students? And I'm myself teaching at a large sixth form with a very white Anglo population that my own attempts have seemed rather tokenistic, particularly in relation to Black History Month. Also thinking about, do these aspects only really relate within the prism of British Empire studies in relation to, say, the teaching of migration? How would a teacher who was interested but have absolutely no knowledge even start to build lessons on African kingdoms? And what period, what part of Africa? Why is this important anyway? Are there other areas where widening curriculum focus could be applied, say, for instance, in teaching more traditional areas like early 20th century German history? These are all, I think, really difficult questions for so many teachers who feel it's important to do something in this regard, but don't know what exactly and have no idea where to start. That's why I'm so happy to be joined by Josh Pregari to discuss and hopefully provide much greater knowledge on these key issues. Josh is head of history at a school in Southwest London. He's an author, public speaker, a graduate student from the University of Oxford. He began teaching in 2014 and has taught in several London schools. He's written and worked for the exam boards on these key topics relating to African kingdoms and migration to Britain. He's also the 2022 National Diversity Award winner. As head of history, Josh led the creation of a curricula which has given voice to those groups who have been silenced by the past. He's also looking at decolonization of the English curriculum, which I'm really interested in. Although we both are history teachers, I'm interested in exploring how these key ideas relate to other subjects as well. So hopefully Josh is online and coming through. Can you hear me, Josh?
I can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear me?
You're a little bit quiet, but I can hear you okay.
All right. Give me 2 moments. Let me see if I can kind of...
Okay. No worries.
One moment. Sorry. Can you hear me a bit better now?
It's still a little quiet. Why don't we go to the news just for a second, and then and hopefully when I come back, I can hear you a bit louder if you just want to see if you can get it any louder than that.
All right, no problem.
Okay.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
According to reports on the BBC News website, the EU wants to agree a deal with the UK that would make it easier for people aged between 18 and 30 to study abroad in the wake of Brexit. The European Commission says it would be a limited arrangement, not the restoration of freedom of movement. The UK already has schemes with some non-EU countries, and these allow people to come to the UK for up to 2 years. Downing Street says it's open to extending this to individual EU members rather than throughout the EU, but prefers country-by-country deals. The proposed EU scheme has time limits, and UK participants would only be able to stay in the EU country that accepted them. The report goes on to say that it would reduce controls on young people moving between the UK and EU. The European Commission says it is stepping in after the UK approached several EU countries to discuss deals. The Commission says it risked differential treatment of EU citizens, and there should be a bloc-wide deal for equality. The UK turned down an offer to continue participating in the EU's Erasmus student exchange after Brexit, but did replace it with the Turing scheme, which provides exchanges worldwide. The BBC South East team have covered concerns expressed by some students that they may run out of ADHD medication during the upcoming exam period. Some students have reported rationing their medication in order to stretch it out following reports of shortages due to an increase in demand and manufacturing issues. ADHD medications are often controlled drugs, which means prescriptions are limited to a month's supply, although some pharmacies also struggle to fill even this. The NHS advises against any changes of dosage without medical advice, but families continue to feel anxious about the possibility of young people struggling through the exam season. The Guardian reports on findings from communications regulator Ofcom, which suggests that a quarter of 3- and 4-year-olds in the UK now own a smartphone. Half of children under 13 are on social media. Online activity by infant school-aged children is rising. These findings could boost the argument of those urging the government to clamp down on social media and phone use by young children. A consultation will likely be launched in coming weeks, according to sources in government. This could include a proposal to ban mobile phone sales to under 16s, one to make it easier for parents to use parental controls on devices, and one to raise the minimum age for social media sites from 13 to 16. Michelle Donlan, Technology Secretary, said children as young as 5 should not be accessing social media. The Ofcom figures come amid what The Guardian says is growing evidence of the impact of social media use amongst children, and the US government refers to it as a profound risk to mental health. The book, The Anxious Generation, published in March by a US academic, has been cited as influencing thinking in number 10. The Ofcom survey was based on 2,480 parents of children aged between 3 and 17. The TES reports that absence rates are up again according to latest DfE figures. This is compared with spring 2022-23. This is despite the government's ongoing attendance drive. Overall absence for last term was 7.3%, slightly up on the 7% in the previous year. The Department for Education said the rise was likely to have been caused by a higher level of illness absence. The proportion of persistently absent pupils has also slightly increased to 21.9% of pupils who were missing 10% or more half days. The figures for disadvantaged pupils are worse when compared to their peers. Full details of the latest data can be found on TES.com. Finally, the TES also features a report that the Department for Education does not intend to replace current progress measures, known as Progress 8, for the next 2 years. After exploring alternatives, there will be no progress measures published for schools in England in 2024-25 or 2025-26. The cancellation of Year 6 SATs during the pandemic meant that there was no Key Stage 2 attainment data available as a baseline for Progress 8 calculations. Headline attainment measures will still be published and grading will take place as normal. The Department for Education says it intends to return to Progress 8 in 2026-27. Teaching unions welcomed the announcement, but some described it as a missed opportunity to rethink performance tables overall. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Cool. How are you going, Josh?
I am all good. I am hoping that you can hear me a lot better.
Very, very good. You're coming through absolutely perfect. Cool. Yeah, thanks for joining us so much, Josh. Really excited about tonight. I think it's going to be great. I just thought to start, can you just let us know a little bit about your background, how you've been inspired in your teaching sort of through your journey, and how it's guided the key areas you're interested in terms of diversity in education?
Yeah, of course. Firstly, thank you for the opportunity. I'm really, really happy and pleased to be on the show. I think when reflecting on my background, I think it's very important for me to reflect on the fact that, you know, growing up as a Black British Nigerian in South London, Brixton, that had a profound impact on me growing up. And I've mentioned it, you know, in a number of places. Growing up, I always had a bittersweet relationship with history, but I never saw myself. And I think, so for me, it was very, very important, A, for people who are like me not to have that experience. And then going a bit further, I wanted to try my best to ensure that, you know, students would leave my classroom with, you know, all kinds of students would leave my classroom with, you know, really, really important knowledge. So, for example, when looking at migration and African Judas, I think it's very important for people to know that the presence of Black people in Britain, you know, predates the Empire Windrush in 1948. I think there's powerful knowledge for them to know about people like Septimius Severus and also the African Judas. So I think a combination of my background and, you know, wanting to make sure all of our students who leave my classroom are equipped with that powerful knowledge is really important. And I must give a massive shout out to, you know, two other people really who have had a, you know, really, really important influence in my career. First off being Martin Spafford. I think what happened during my initial teacher training process, it was actually a process that I found rather difficult. But Martin delivered a session back then on diversity. And I literally came to life. It was the first time I came across Friar's book, first time I came across people like Stephen Bourne. And it just brought me to life. And I was so engaged at that point. And then, you know, secondly, got to give a big shout out to Jason Todd as well, because in this kind of journey I've embarked on in decolonizing the curriculum, which, you know, it's a process that never ends, I've been able to come across some really, really powerful information that has, you know, constantly challenged me and shifted my thinking. So yeah, that's how I've been influenced. My background being a Black British Nigerian male, growing up from Brixton, and you know, the people in the wonderful history community that I've come across have really shaped me. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested in that because obviously you got into history and teaching and then met those individuals that inspired you further. So, I mean, did you feel when you were at school marginalized in terms of history and what you're being taught? Was it something that you were aware of at the time, or is it only later when you look back and thought, hang on a second, there was a lot of stuff that was left out?
No, I think I always had questions, you know, questions simply like, can I really be Black and British? Can I really be Black and English? You know, how come we, like, why are we here? And questions like that were, you know, questions that were really, really on my mind. And then, you know, you'd often come across, you know, types of history that you wouldn't necessarily find in the, you know, main curriculum. And I think for me, it was, there was kind of that, I guess, that trying, that I don't want to use the word conflict, but trying to find, okay, so this history that I may be finding out from, you know, my parents, is this accurate? Or the history I come across in the classroom, is that accurate? And you've got to also put that in the context of growing up. You know, I studied history at Kisei Tree, I did history A level, I did history at undergrad. So, you know, I'd studied history for a considerable amount of time. And no, I never ever saw myself. And I guess I did have questions. But I guess I kind of always put it to the side, because for me, growing up and being a Black male, it was always about doing well. You know, my parents always, you know, stressed the importance of doing well academically, because for them, that would provide me with a level of stability and safety. So I had these questions, but I often put them to the back of my mind because I was just conscious and concerned about just progressing, really.
I mean, that's really interesting, because I think a lot of people, well, I don't know, a lot of teachers or people who are interested in history sort of maybe get into it because they see something in the subject that maybe links to their background or of interest. But I'm interested just to look at that a tiny bit further, in the sense that, like, what interested you in the subject to go so far in it despite the questions you had and the sort of feeling of marginalization?
Funnily enough, so I think what happened, so growing up, being Nigerian, the Biafran Civil War was huge. It was a monumental event that occurred in Nigerian history, right? But I never learned about it. We never, ever spoke about that at home. I found out about the Biafran Civil War through Half of a Yellow Sun. And I remember coming home, asking my parents about it. They said, yeah, you know, this had happened. And I said, well, why have you never thought to tell me about it? So I always had the interest in history. But I think growing up initially, like when I was thinking about my career, I didn't necessarily come at it from, you know, a passion in history. I think history just happened to actually be something I did and I was good at. My initial kind of prompt for getting into education was really about working around young people. I'd worked with young people for a considerable amount of time, and I wanted a career that would allow me to give back and support those people. I just happened to have a history A level and a history undergrad degree that lent itself towards teaching history. It wasn't until I embarked on the teacher training process that I actually really, really encountered my Black history, because I'd never studied it in school. So what actually happened was, in the process of, you know, teaching others about Black history, I was actually teaching myself. I was consuming, you know, lots and lots. I was consuming volumes of books, reading so many things about it, and then bringing it into the classroom. And then that's where my real passion came, because, okay, history was something I happened to do. History was something I was good at. But then I started to find history that I found really, really interesting, that spoke to me. But I also found that it spoke to the young people that I was teaching.
Were you sort of not alone in your class, but were you unique in your interest in history when you were coming through school and going on? Or was it something that was quite vibrant in your, like, high school, or was it seen as, you know, something maybe a little bit different in terms of pursuing that sort of aspect in terms of art subjects?
No, so I wasn't different, but I think what it was for me growing up, and the sixth form college I went to, St. Francis Xavier Sixth Form College, it was amazing. But history was a means to an end. So a lot of students and loads of black students in my class studied history at A level, but they never went on to study it at undergrad. What they recognized was history was a well-respected qualification, hence why you would do it. What actually happened with me was I wanted to originally embark in a career in law. And I was advised, study history and then do a conversion course. So even whilst I was studying it at undergrad, it was a means to an end. And that kind of links to even what my my undergrad dissertation. My undergrad dissertation was on, the history that can be learned from the financial crisis. And once again, I was doing that because I was trying to make myself as marketable in, the world of employment as possible. But what was actually funny was my friend who was studying at the same time, he did his dissertation on the Biafran Civil War. And I was so annoyed because I thought, I would have loved to have done that, but I did this to kind of get by. And it links to when I got into my career. Originally, it was about working with young people. I found out that I was good at history, but then through learning about, black history, I started to really, really, develop that strong passion that I guess I maybe didn't have as strongly in the past.
So can you just sort of go through, for those of us who are not familiar, and I can't say I am very familiar with the person that you mentioned, the first inspiration. So you were doing your teacher training. You said you went to a lecture, I think it was, with a key individual that said that really opened up your ideas about Black history. Can you just give us a bit more background on that person and what meant for you?
So firstly, so his name is Martin Spafford, and he is he's an absolute legend. And I remember, so there's so many things happened, but I remember, so he started off the lecture with, the first ever shot fired during the First World War for Britain was fired by a black man, Elhanji Grunji. He said, and Elhanji Grunji was from what is the Gold Coast, what is today Ghana. So he said that, and I was taken aback. I said, come on, this can't be the case. How do I not know this? And then he then went on to talk about Stephen Bourne's mother country, because we were looking at, for example, evacuations during the Second World War. He was showing photographs of, black kids being evacuated during the Second World War. And look, a lot of people may have known about this, but I didn't. I didn't know anything about this. And so I was so fascinated. And what actually happened was after the lecture, I went up to him and I just said, what you delivered was fascinating. Would you be, happy if I took your email? So I took his email and we stayed in touch. And, I would see him at various conferences, and it was through our work with Professor Hakim Addy, when Professor Hakim Addy launched the History Matters campaign, that we started to work even more. So Martin took a keen interest in me, because on the one hand, I think he took a keen interest in my development as a teacher and professionally, and I think he really, really helped me there. But we had interests that aligned, and so he would, feed me more and more information. And I just kept on reading. I kept on bringing things into the classroom. I kept on running ideas by him. And I think what was quite helpful about him is, he was at the end of his career, if not retiring. And I was someone who was just starting my career. So it was always really helpful to speak to him, because he would always provide me with a sense of perspective, whether it be what history was like in the past, or whether it was, different strategies to deliver particular units and stuff. He was just really helpful. So I'd always bounce ideas with him, and he'd always share things with me. And then it just developed in me, had a really, really great, developed a great relationship and friendship, I'd say.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So if we think about the classroom, with these issues and the things you're talking about, what difference do you think it makes to a young person looking at a more diverse history curriculum, in comparison to maybe something that you experienced?
Good. I think that's a good question. And that kind of links into what I'm currently studying now. So one of the arguments I've made is that by looking at a more, a decolonized or diverse curriculum, it makes the curriculum far more relevant to young people, because history at its very core is about the questions that we're asking about the past. And history tries to provide some of those answers. And I think a lot of young people are asking a number of questions about the past, about, you know, the diversity within Britain, about how we got here. You know, how we got here is a big question I'm often asked. And, you know, even asking, if you go back to, you know, the awful murder of George Floyd that happened over in the United States, you had people from the United Kingdom asking, okay, this happened over on the other side of the Atlantic, but why do we feel that pain? But also, why does racism in America take a slightly different, take on a slightly different form in comparison to racism in the UK? I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't similarities and differences, but, you know, if you just look at it historically, where, you know, a number of the enslaved Africans were forced to work on the plantations in America and in the Americas, whereas, you know, the plantations within the UK, within the United Kingdom, or were part of the British Empire, and those are often in the Caribbean. It kind of, you know, it kind of does allude to, you know, our relationship with it, because quite often in Britain, whilst I'd always argue the British Empire was part of Britain, it was kind of out of sight, out of mind, and it allowed Britain to kind of engage with that, with those conversations around race in a different way. So I think number one, it makes the curriculum more relevant, because you are able to start to answer some of the questions that they are asking. I think it also paints a far more accurate and representative picture of the past that allows, you know, their local heroes and people of their family to feature. You know, we're currently looking at Notting Hill with our year 10s, you know, and there are a number of students who have mentioned, you know, they have grandparents who had property in Notting Hill. Or, for example, with our Asian parent, with our Asian students, when looking at the migration course, looking at, for example, looking at Whitechapel and that story. So I think it really makes history relevant, and it allows them just to question, you know, how knowledge is kind of created, how knowledge is stored, and, you know, how certain pieces of knowledge are silenced as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on something you were saying, because, you know, being a migrant to the UK myself, something that really struck me when I began teaching here was how much in this particular area of Surrey and Hampshire that I'm in, how much students had so much greater knowledge of the civil rights movement, the Black civil rights movement in the United States, and, you know, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, than they had any knowledge of Black Britain, even Brixton and sort of stuff you might think about that's more recent in the 70s and 80s. I mean, I guess there's sort of three parts of my question. Do you think that's still the case? Do you think it is a problem? And why is it still, is it getting better, or is it still sort of tends to be an issue, and why might that be?
I think it still is the case, but it is changing. We are starting to have more of a focus around what happened here, whether it be Claudia Jones and Notting Hill, whether it's, you know, the Bristol bus boycotts. I think we are starting to see those changes, and I think we are starting to see those changes because the exam boards are starting to change their modules, and also at Key Stage 3, a lot of work has gone into the creation of textbooks that explore these stories and these histories. The question of why it happens, I think the topic of the British Empire is a very, very difficult topic that hasn't been tackled well in history, in the, you know, British history education. For such a long time, the focus was on, you know, was the empire good or was the empire bad? You know, instead of asking other questions in terms of, you know, how did people resist the empire? What were people's experiences of the British Empire? And making sure that there's that key understanding that, you know, the empire was Britain. So even when you're looking at, for example, I was delivering a session on the 1948 Nationality Act, and someone said to me that, look, like, when people came over from the Caribbean, they weren't migrants, they were settlers. If somebody moved from Wales to England, you wouldn't call that person a migrant, you'd call them a settler. Same too,
if you lived in Jamaica at the time, you were British. So you're moving from one part of the empire to another. And I think that, you know, that story around the empire, as massive as it was, hasn't really been explored fully. It hasn't been taught fully. And what was, you had a final question. I forgot, what was your final question again?
Well, just like, you know, it, do you see it as a problem? I guess, you know, it's definitely not unique to Britain. I mean, my education in Australia was very similar. We knew way more about civil rights movements in the United States than anything that happened in Australia over the 20th century in terms of civil rights movements with Indigenous people there. Do you think it's just a case of, it's sort of more comfortable, isn't it, to learn about another country and their controversies without sort of touching on the controversies within your own country?
Precisely. And there's, you know, there's been articles about it, because it ultimately, it forces you to look at the mirror and forces you to confront some of the challenges or some of the issues that you have. It's very easy to look at, you know, civil rights in the United States. It's very easy to study the Holocaust in Germany, because those things happened over there. But when looking at, for example, the concentration camps in Kenya, not many people know about that. You know, when looking at, you know, the role of Britain in the Biafran Civil War, not many people know about that, because it forces us to have uncomfortable conversations about a past that's difficult, really, really, really difficult.
Yeah, I want to get into that quite a bit in terms of, I think for a lot of teachers, teaching controversial areas is just so difficult. I mean, I guess my other question would be, you know, do you think it is... You know, is it history? Is it like, you know, is it uniquely placed to tackle these areas, do you think, or other subjects that are involved? Like, we're both sort of history teachers, and I think there's a lot of focus on history. So is history, do you think, as a subject, uniquely placed to tackle these issues, or can you see it in where other subjects might also sort of fit in?
I think the first thing that's quite important to understand is history is not neutral. History's political, and it always has been political. And I think so understanding that history is not neutral and understanding that history is political allows you to become a lot more comfortable in, like you said, handling those very, very uncomfortable topics. And I think obviously it can be hard when it spills into, you know, modern day issues as history tends to. But I think history is important because it could provide an origin to a story. And it can kind of explain to students the way in which we got here. So, of course, but I don't think that it's something that's unique to history. I think, for example, a number of issues can be explored in subjects like English, for example, like PSHE, like religious studies. I think all of these subjects provide an opportunity to, you know, explore really difficult issues. But I think history is... sociology too is a really, really good example, sorry. But I think what history does, which is unique to those other subjects, is it allows you to look back at the past. It allows you to engage in debates, but also understanding the historiography and how, you know, almost understanding that, look, certain narratives and claims about the past are made. Right, but these narratives and these claims can be challenged through evidence. And it's when you engage with that evidence, it can become really powerful, because by engaging with that evidence and by engaging with those narratives, you're also able to give voices that were once silenced a platform. You know, so I think history does a really good job in that.
Yeah. So I was reading some of the stuff you've written and watching some of this stuff online this week, and I was really interested in a quote I picked up from, and sorry if I've butchered the quote a little bit, but I saw something you'd said where you said that Black history is British history and that you can't accurately teach British history without teaching Black history. I think I've got that right. Can you just explain that a bit more? I was really interested in that quote, but I think, yeah, I'm really interested in what you sort of meant by that.
I'm going to start that quote with what Peter Fryer said when he said, look, there are Africans in Britain before the English came, you know, and what I've said 100 times, but when we talk about the English, we talk about the Angles, the Saxons and Jutes who came from what is modern day Germany. But I think what I was trying to say is, if you look at every single significant aspect of British history, whether it be the Romans, the Tudors, the Industrial Revolution, the First World War, the Second World. When you look at a number of these events that we regard as significant, there's a heavy presence of Black people within them, you know? And so I ask the question, how can you teach history without accurately reflecting the contribution and the presence of these people to these shores? You know, we've always been here. If you want to go far back as Cheddar Man, the first ever Briton was a Black man. So I think that it's very, very important to understand that if you're going to teach it accurately, you are going to include these other stories. You are going to include these other narratives because we constantly feature throughout. And when I talk about British history, I'm not just referring to the history of the British Isles. You know, as a result of the British Empire, those colonies are part of Britain. So what occurred in those colonies is part of British history as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I also read where you pointed out key issues and how the transatlantic slave trade is often taught. And I think I was reading where you said that when it used to be taught, when you were taught it in schools, as a school student, it made you feel quite depressed, as it obviously was, but also about how the content itself was presented. I just wonder if you could dig into that, because obviously it's a big topic with teachers. I mean, I teach it in the sense of its beginnings as purely almost as an economic sense, and then why it was obviously abolished, both the slave trade and then the ownership of slaves. But it's very much seen as like part of a trade unit I teach. I'm just interested in how you approach it. Like, what, I guess, two questions. What was the big issue you saw as a student that made you, you know, feel that it wasn't a topic that was speaking to you or gave you anything else apart from just feeling like, oh, this is horrible, to how you now approach it to your students? And also, you know, something practical for teachers who are approaching that topic.
Cool. I mean, it was a long time ago when I first encountered the topic, but the image that always comes out to my mind is not funny, but it's quite harrowing. It's the image of Frederick Douglass with the scars on his back. And I was in a multicultural school, but you've got to remember, the only time we would have ever encountered Black history in that school, because I can remember it so vividly, it was year 8. I can't ever remember coming across Black history. And then suddenly I'm shown this image of Frederick Douglass with scars in his back. And I'm looking to the left, I'm looking to the right. And I want you know, the ground to swallow me, because that gives me no sense of pride. And then I think it's even like smaller conversation in the classroom amongst some of my friends. It's, I didn't know much about Black history. So the only thing I knew was we were enslaved, and it kind of perpetuated the myth that Africa is a continent and the countries within Africa were always poor, were always backwards. So it gave me nothing to be proud of, you know, gave me nothing whatsoever to be proud of. And you've got to kind of look at that in the context of the other history I'm taught, whether it's Henry VIII or, you know, William of Normandy. It very, very much celebrates the achievements of, you know, white people. So as a young person growing up, trying to grapple and understand the issue of race, although back then is a far more insidious thing. No one ever spoke about race when I was growing up. It was insidious. You felt it, you knew it was there, but we never spoke about it. But that made it very difficult for me, because I was forming my identity, and the only thing I could grasp that was linked to my identity was horrible. And like I said, it wasn't just about what it did for me. It was also about what it did for my white friends, my Asian friends. It's okay, we've shown you African history. This is all African history has to show. And then even if you want to go a bit further, I remember geography as well. And this is aside, we were looking at, I can't remember the term, but like kind of underdeveloped countries, and we looked at Ghana. So, you know, the only times I've encountered myself or something like myself was awful. But as I got older, I guess a key thing for me when, you know, teaching of the transatlantic slave trade was putting it in its context. You know, Toby Green says it's a significant history that has to be taught. And I don't think you can avoid it, but you've got to also put in the context that, look, it's 400 years of history. African history is thousands of years old, whether you look at the ancient Egyptians, whether you look at, you know, one of my favorites, the Kingdom of Benin. There's so many rich, rich examples that you could also teach your students. And that kind of feeds into what we do at my current school. We've kind of, what we've done is we have like golden threads that kind of link our curriculum from, link our curriculum from year seven right the way through to year 11. So in year seven, and this is kind of an, you know, some strategies for how I approach the teaching of the transatlantic slave trade, as well as the teaching of Black history. In year seven, our students look at race, but we don't actually talk about race explicitly. They have a unit where they look at the Kingdom of Benin. They also look at migration through looking at the migration of some of the African Romans that came. And we also have a significance unit where we look at how West Green Road has changed over time. And we look at, you know, multi-million pound businesses like Dyke and Dresden. So what that does is, A, through looking at the African Romans, it lets them know that the presence in Britain has, you know, been at least over a millennium long. By looking at Dyke and Dresden and how West Green Road has changed, it links to them. And then by finally looking at, you know, African kingdoms in year seven, they're able to see the rich and powerful history of Africa, just outside the lens of the transatlantic slave trade. They're able to look at Africa as a historical phenomenon of itself. We then go into year eight, and our key focus in year eight, one of the golden threads is resistance. So we, you know, we go back and we briefly look at some of, you know, Africa prior to the transatlantic slave trade, because it's important to give it context. But then our approach to the transatlantic slave trade is through the lens of resistance. Resistance is something that we very, very much focus on. I did a historical fellowship with Abdul and Robin from Justice for History, and what I made was looking at how the transatlantic slave trade underdeveloped the Kingdom of Benin. So I focused specifically on the Kingdom of Benin, but how it also led to, you know, Britain further developing. And that's quite relevant when looking at what someone like Kemi Badenoch has said, where she's argued that, you know, Britain's success has nothing to do with its links to enslavement, which is, you know, factually incorrect. Then once we've looked at resistance in year nine, we push it a bit forward. So we look at Walter Toll and his contribution in World War One, but also the racism that he may have experienced that he kind of leaves out. And then finally, we go to, you know, that process of decolonization of, you know, countries gaining independence from the British Empire, migration to Britain, post 1948, Windrush, that Black civil rights struggle. And what that kind of does is that kind of tells a long story. And I think the practical tool I'm giving is, you know, if you're going to teach a transatlantic slave trade, A, you don't start in a transatlantic slave trade. You started with pre-colonial African kingdoms. B, making sure that you're quite clear that, you know, as a result of the transatlantic slave trade, this construct of race was born. That's what you have. And it's very important when looking at, you know, topics like the Holocaust, these ideas were kind of birthed then. And then kind of playing it forward and letting young people understand, okay, that's what, you know, that's contributed to society today. Because even if I go forward to year 10, we look at, for example, we study the migration course, and we study the US civil rights course as well. And that kind of gives them a fuller appreciation of A, how we got here, and B, you know, Britain's relationship with race. And we firmly keep it in the context of Britain.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, so, so interesting. I've got so many follow-up questions, and some of the more sort of, I guess, the debate around this topic and some of the issues that have been raised by other people. I've got some questions coming in. I think this is a good time to take a word from our sponsors, and then we'll come back and continue this conversation.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Cool, and we're back. So I've got a few questions coming in, Josh, that I just getting from some of our listeners. So Rob Hardy was asking, do you agree that still today there is an overemphasis on slavery when schools promote Black History Month particularly? And I was going to raise this with you. My institution, I think I'm very guilty of it myself. It comes around once a year, you're sort of scrambling for stuff to do. It seems very tokenistic. And he says, like, he's often embarrassed about the posters put up around schools that seem primarily to give Black people significance in terms of their relation to Europe and particularly slavery. And he finds it quite reductious. I'm having trouble pronouncing that word tonight. Is that something you would agree with? And I guess my follow-up question, which I was going to ask you, is how do you, and I think it's always a big issue, it's something I'm interested in, how do you make Black History Month less tokenistic?
Man, these are good questions. I think the first one around, you know, the old, you know, how, you know, do I think that schools still promote Black History Month in the lens of slavery? It's quite hard because, you know, I could only ever talk from my own personal context in terms of the school I work at or the schools that I've worked at in the past. So in terms of the schools I'm working at and the schools I worked at in the past, no, you know, that doesn't appear to be the case. However, when I do speak to young people and I do speak to parents, that often is the case. They, you know, quite often they tell me that, you know, they don't learn much Black history, don't learn much about Black history in school. And, you know, if they do learn about Black history in school, it's often more from the US perspective as opposed to what's happening or what happened in the UK. And I think, look, there are two things. I think celebrate Black History Month by all means. You know, I actually went through a funny stage where in one of my previous schools, I was against Black History Month simply because, and I don't want this to be a wrong soundbite, I believe that where Black history is British history, it needs to be taught 365 days a year. So it should be in the curriculum all the time. So that's what I believed. But the issue you had with that is whilst I had that energy and I had that passion, that wasn't shared by all members of staff in the school. So what would happen is, not only would Black History Month not be celebrated, but students wouldn't encounter positive Black history within the school. So I had to kind of move away from that. I think Black History Month is important, but I think, you know, we're in 2024 now, schools need to be moving towards a more representative curriculum. Like in my school, we've got this amazing curriculum pillar, which basically says, look, our curriculum needs to be a mirror for our students to see themselves, but also a window for them to look and see other cultures. And I think that, and it's not something that you can do individually, otherwise you get tired, that, you know, it's something that at a senior leadership level, it's something that they have to be committed to. It's something that heads of department have to be committed to. And look, I'm also a realist. I recognize that, you know, we've got pressure of exam results. You know, we've got, you know, time is one of the most precious commodities in the profession amongst all the other challenges we face. So I understand that. But I think that in order for it to be meaningful, it's something that you have to commit to, and you've got to see where it has to become a feature of your school. It has to be something that, you know, your students are encountering. So if it's World War One, what stories are you telling about World War One? What stories are you telling about World War Two? If you're, you know, studying maths, for example, are you only talking about European mathematical ideas, or are you sharing mathematical ideas that were discovered and found elsewhere? Sociology, what kind of sociologists are you exposing your students to? And look, you've got to go beyond, you know, reading lists and representation, but it's asking, though, it's presenting students with those bodies of knowledge that allow them to see, you know, the contributions of Black people. Because then what starts to happen is they don't only encounter Black history during Black History Month, they start to encounter it in all of their subjects.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of answered my question. I was thinking when you were answering, wouldn't like success in what you're talking about would that not mean, like, success would actually mean not needing to have Black History Month, like in a strange sort of way, would not like having to have like something specific like that be a mark of success? Because like you said, Black history just becomes history. I mean, I'm not saying that will ever happen, but wouldn't that like ideally be the sort of not end point, but be a marker of success?
Yeah, and I agree. I think the kind of perfect situation, as you said, is a situation whereby, you know, our students are encountering accurate British history, accurate Black history so much that, you know, that need to celebrate Black history for 1 month isn't there. Now, look, we've always got to understand where Black History Month came from as well, you know, so starting off in the States and eventually coming over to the UK, I think in 1987, I believe. Yeah, it started because of that lack of recognition. You know, that was the key thing. It started because of that lack of recognition. So if we're getting it right and the recognition is far more accurate, then I guess the need for it isn't the same. But I'd be careful because London is quite unique to the rest of the country. And so I think it's, whilst that might be easy to achieve in London, it might not be so easy to achieve in other parts of the UK. And so I can understand why students and parents would be reluctant for it not to feature in other parts of the UK, because it can provide opportunities just to not teach it at all, as I found in one of my previous schools.
Yeah, I've got another question coming in. I've got so many questions. So Dan McGrath is asking, he says he totally agrees with you. Do exam boards need to do more work on this to include a wider range of case studies that are representative of our rich cultural history? I mean, I know you've worked with certain exam boards. Do you think they're doing enough? I know it's difficult to sort of, you know, maybe criticize them, but is there more? There's always more to do, but do you think they're, where are we about with exam boards, do you think? And how are things going?
This is interesting. So I've got, how do I say? I think, this is what I think about exam, and I can only talk about the exam boards I'm working with. I can't speak for all of them. I think they definitely have the year, and they definitely have the intention. They definitely want to do more. And I think exam boards and publishers have gone beyond the point of looking at just the sale. So look, let's face facts. Exam boards are a business. Publishers are a business. And in the past, it was often about the sales, whereas now they're open and they want to produce these histories. I think what's stopping exam boards at the moment is, you know, the current political situation. Once, you know, we've had that kind of that situation resolved, then there's clear direction in terms of what needs to happen in education. I think the last key reform came in 2016. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, it sure did. Yeah.
So exam boards are at a position where they can't change much until the next reform happens. But, and also it depends on what the government say they want that reform to look like. But I'm under the impression, based off the work I've been doing, that exam boards are incredibly keen to start pushing through these changes. That's my understanding. And they're keen, not only are they keen, they're kind of, they understand that it's an ethical issue. And so profits aren't necessarily going to be their motivating factor. And I'll explain to you a little bit about what I mean. So with a particular exam board, you've got four units, and within that kind of bucket of topics, you have Weimar and Nazi Germany, which is the most popular topic that every single school does, right? Mm-hmm. On the flip side, you also have China within that, which hardly any school does. And at a point, that topic on China was at the risk of actually being removed because, you know, financially it was no longer viable. Whereas based on the conversations I've had, and look, I don't know much and things would change, they are prepared to continue to place those subjects in irrespective of what's happening because they recognize that it's important to have them there.
Yeah, that's super interesting. My other question, which sort of comes from what you said about London. So for myself, like I'm teaching at a very white Anglo-dominated institution. So if history is important in terms of widening the curriculum for those schools, you're talking about, you know, in London with a diverse population, what would you say to someone who says, like, you know, basically where I'm teaching, well, given the background of my students, that's not really relevant to my setting. I could see why it would be relevant to an inner city London school, but that's not the context of my students. What would your argument be back to them?
I think it's quite simple. I think it's even more important because of that. And I can give you an example. So I think as history teachers, as educators and, you know, people who play a fundamental part in developing young people, it's important that we remember our pastoral role and our role in developing young people. And what that often means is we are actually quite biased in terms of the histories and stories we select. And I'll give you an example. And this example is not even necessarily linked to Black history. You know, where I teach, I can give you two examples. I've made the conscious decision of including certain types of history. So we have an amazing unit that was, you know, developed by Dan Linden. It's called Parliament Pop or Protest. What has done more to advance the position of the LGBTQ plus community in Britain, right? And initially in teaching that unit, there's quite a lot of backlash. However, in teaching that unit, it's been really, really important because what that started to do is challenge deep-rooted ideas around the LGBTQ community, and it's allowed them to understand that historical fight, that historical campaign. And even now, we actually just finished it, and we've had students who the outcome was a digital archive, and they absolutely loved it. Moving forward, I was speaking to Pete Jackson, who teaches in rural Yorkshire, I believe, and just like you, he teaches in a context that's predominantly white, but for him, that's all the more reason why it's important to teach, you know, or look at the British Empire, to look at Black history, because we are developing young people who are going to go into the world. And if these young people do not encounter a more accurate representation of the past, you run the risk of recreating those kind of negative ideas and negative stereotypes that we're trying to challenge. So, yeah, I think that'd be what my argument to it is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess it seems to be that a lot of the criticisms that I'm seeing about decolonization and, you know, widening the curriculum seem to be based on an idea that that's all you do, like that students are only learning about themselves and creating, I guess, one of the criticisms I saw is something like silos of history, like you only learn about what's relevant to yourself. But I could pick up from what you're saying is like you do this alongside the sort of, I guess, let's call them the more traditional topics like Germany. It's not an exception. You're not cutting out one thing to do another. You're putting it all together, which I think is what a lot of these criticisms miss out.
But I think even that criticism, even when reforming the curriculum, we're always cutting out things and including things. Like, that's the whole idea of significance, right? We are choosing to place an emphasis on specific events and specific people over others. That's what happens in the curriculum, because we can't teach everything. We can't teach everything in history. So when anyone creates a curriculum or anybody starts to think about, you know, units to put in an exam board, you do ask questions about, you know, what is important? What kind of knowledge do we need our students to have when we leave? What kind of things are they going to find interesting? What's going to engage them? What's going to answer some of the questions? So, of course, like I said, we do look at, you know, some of the more traditional forms of history, but equally we're committed to making, because, you know, there's this really, really interesting, Martin, he always inspires me, but he said something once not too long ago in one of his lectures. And, you know, it was when thinking about like William of Normandy, for example, we focus on William of Normandy, but was he the only one? Was he the only person involved? You know, we quite often we have this top-down history that focuses on key political figures, which I guess is important, but what about the other people? And at the very heart of decolonization, it's about a bottom-up history. It's about those people who were marginalized, who were powerless, who didn't have a voice in history. It's about allowing them to tell their stories. Not this year, but a couple of years ago, we looked at the Reformation through the voices of Marbath, right? That's a great example of for such a long time, when we'd focus on the Reformation, it was about what Henry VIII did, and it was about, you know, his break from Rome. But we never really encountered what happened to the people on the ground. The Voice of Morbeth, that inquiry did an awesome job of explaining the impact it had. And that's what decolonization is all about for me, whether it's working class history, whether it's Black history, whether it's the history of women, whether it's people from the LGBTQ community. It's about those people who are marginalized teaching that history. And there's so many events you can go through, and it's just about, okay, so what part did these people play in the building of this country? I think, I'm just trying to give another example. We looked at, you know, our students currently study the migration course, right? And we have such a heavy emphasis on the industrial revolution, which is important. But when we do it, and we're able to look at, for example, the potato famine, which led to that massive migration of, you know, people from Ireland to the UK, and how, you know, that migration to Liverpool docks, building the canals, working on the railroads. They built Britain just as much as anyone else, but for a long time, we didn't really tell that story, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this sounds amazing, Josh. I mean, it sounds like the sort of history I'd like to be doing. But just want to ask a bit more about this. So we're thinking about sort of, I guess, some of the debate around this, and one of the things that's raised a lot that you hear from, yes, you know, more conservative commentators on this, is this idea that, oh, teaching this sort of angle just gives students a negative view of Britain. And I guess there's sort of two parts, well, I guess there's three parts to my question. The first one would be, you know, do you agree that that is an issue? And the second part is, you know, is that the purpose of history anyway, is to create sort of, you know, a national feeling and sort of pride in your country? So what do you think about those sort of criticisms when you hear them, that's like, oh, well, decolonization is just teaching young people all the negative aspects, you know, like you were saying, I think it was Badenoch who was, you mentioned before, and her idea that, oh, we need to, you know, learn more about the good things Britain did at the empire. What are your feelings when you hear comments like that?
Yeah, I've got to be careful, because when I hear about Badenoch, you know, your blood boils when I hear Badenoch saying we need to teach people about the good stuff that Britain did in the empire. But look, I'll step back and I'll be like, look, that's such a reductive argument to say that, you know, teaching a decolonized history will result in people having a bad and negative idea of Britain. I'll give you an example. So I'm currently, it's one of the things I'm working on, actually. And so what our students are doing is they're looking at Colin Grant. So Colin Grant wrote a book called Voices of the Windrush. And what they're doing is for their next project, they're finding out, you know, how am I trying to articulate this? How Colin Grant was able to tell his story so that they can tell theirs. And I'm going to try explaining it a bit more. We had a Holocaust, a relative of a Holocaust survivor come into our school in February. And one of the things she said during the end of her presentation was, look, all of the history that I was able to tell you was passed down orally, okay? But we've documented it. I mean, I've documented it. I've archived it. And that has allowed me to tell this history to you. Now, you need to do the same, because we come from such rich communities in Britain, but we don't document those histories. We don't tell those histories. And if we don't document those histories, and we don't tell those histories, that history will become silent. People won't know about it. So what we've done at my school is we're giving our young people the opportunity. And I think Will Bates did something similar to this, but they're going to be learning about, you know, the process of decolonization, like countries gaining their independence from Britain. They're going to be looking at how a historian, Colin Grant, was able to make this book. And then they're going to be able to go and research these histories for themselves, right? And that's going to result in them finding or coming across some real heroes from their local communities. That's British history to me, just as much as anything else, right?
And that's not negative. What that is doing is that's questioning the production of history. That's questioning how history is stored. That's looking at sources that aren't just written sources, so that young people can find out about those other stories and be really, really proud about the past. So I don't think decolonization only leads to negative history. That's the first thing. But you know what? Even if it does, even if it means that it forces us as young people to ask more critical questions about Britain, I think that's important. I think you could be critical about something, but still love it at the same time, you know? And I think therein itself actually lies one of the biggest problems we have. You know, if you look at Germany, and I think Tom Allen told me a bit about this. So Tom Allen's a friend I've got. Germany had, following the Holocaust, they really, really made a conscious effort in studying and reflecting, and that has allowed Germany to move on in a particular way. And as a country, right, if we really want to move on and if we really want the progress, we've got to ask those questions, look at those episodes. It doesn't mean that it's going to be negative. If anything, you probably learn from those and you move on. What actually happens, and I find it in school as a teacher, what really leads to resentment is the attempt to silence and the attempt of not allowing that conversation and that dialogue to happen. I think that is the bigger danger. So The argument of, you know, say, let's just teach, you know, a positive picture of the past. The young people out there know that this isn't the case. And all you're going to really do is frustrate the young people. Whereas if you're asking questions, okay, so how did we get there? How can we move on? I think you're more likely to, and just have honest conversations, you're more likely to get better engagement. And if that means certain people who are, you know, quite loved by, you know, the national public are criticized, so be it. Because regardless of the historical figures you come across, you know, and that's all about interpretations, in, you know, according to some people, you know, they may be held and revered in a particular way, but other people may not revere them in a particular way. And this whole, because it moves on to our conversations around statues, you know, Colston being a great example. At a particular time, it was chosen to recognize and remember this person in this particular way. This current generation do not place that significance on this individual. But interpretations change all the time. That's history. You know, history isn't a static thing that is just kind of, that doesn't move forward. I don't really buy that argument, if I'm honest.
Yeah, no, that really speaks to me. There's a lot of stuff you're saying. I was thinking, you know, from my own background, that's just, I mean, the debates in Australia are so similar, and we could talk about that for a different thing. But the controversy, the ideas, you know, what are you meant to be achieving in the teaching of Australian history, which can be, you know, very, very depressing at times. And this idea that I don't know if it's still a current thing, but this idea of trying to weigh up history and like, oh, you look at, you know, how much do you look at the good and bad side of Australian history? And it's like, well, can't you look at both and let students decide for themselves? You know, this idea that you could somehow put, you know, oh, it's more negative or, you know, more positive. It depends who you are and your, you know, your background and where you're from and when you arrived in the country. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's so interesting. I guess one of the things, I mean, you might have answered it already, is just what's been the impact, do you think, on your students as you've developed the curriculum and taught it in this really sort of interesting and sort of wider way? What would you say is the impact on students?
I mean, look, I don't fully know yet, but I'd like to believe first and foremost engagement. You know, they are far more interested in what we're studying. But that doesn't mean that, you know, young people don't find it challenging. You know, they even though it's back history, they can still find it challenging. But I like to believe it's more challenging. I like to believe that they recognize that themselves being if they'd like to become historians, that's not something that is, you know, too far removed from them. You know, I think what we're trying to achieve in the long run is a combination of things: more people from, you know, the African Caribbean background taking up history at A level, taking history at undergrad, becoming historians, really, really challenging what's happening in academia, and also seeing improved outcomes across all groups. But
you know, there's a saying, you know, blessed are those who plant the seeds, because they don't often get to see the trees grow. And people have been fighting this fight way before me. I'm relatively new in this, but I do believe that, you know, we may not necessarily see some of all of this immediately, but I think I like to believe in the long run, that's what you would have, you know, more young people studying history, more questions being asked, and yeah, that's it really.
So in terms of your actual classroom, I guess when you're looking at topics like this, it can be quite controversial, I guess, as a teacher and sort of a practical sort of idea. I mean, how do you create the atmosphere that your classroom can be a place of intellectual debate and challenge? I'm sure you get some interesting comments from students about some of these topics, some of which you might not agree with. So whilst also ensuring all students feel included and respected. So just in a sense of a classroom, I think it can be very daunting for teachers, you know, going into some of these topics and thinking, this is going to be really difficult. What happens if student says X? What if they're coming from a certain background, hearing stuff from home? So how do you create that atmosphere when you're teaching controversial topics within a classroom?
Yeah, no, this is really, really good. I think in teaching of Black history, it's, you know, I've got to recognize my positionality in it. And it's something that I might find slightly easier, but putting myself, for example, when we were teaching the LGBTQ plus unit, that was something that was quite hard, because as you mentioned, it wasn't necessarily a history that I was steeped in knowledge with. I was incredibly worried about, or at least concerned about, making sure our students from those kind of backgrounds didn't feel attacked, that they felt safe. You wanted to encourage questions as well. So I think what I did, and every teacher has, you know, a different approach, you know, I've got to look at my strengths and how I kind of did it. And I think being a head of department also helped me to some degree, but it's first, I had a really, really frank and honest conversation with the young people. And in that frank and honest conversation, you know, some young people voiced resistance to it. And I said, well, that's kind of why we have to learn it, because of some of the attitudes that you have. And then going forward, allowing students to ask questions, but also making sure that, you know, you're quite clear in your expectations and clear. Look, you can ask questions, but your questions can't be, you know, disrespectful, and making sure you communicate to them what that might mean, and making sure they understand that there are people within their class, within their community, who are parts of these groups. So they need to feel safe as well. But also just being comfortable in the respect that you may not necessarily have all the answers to all of their questions. And if you don't have all the answers to all their questions, you can find out. And then the final thing was just letting them know that we are studying the history about this. And, you know, in the same way I might study, you know, the history of women, for example, you study the history of various different groups, you let them understand that you are studying the history and this is where we're getting to. And then I think after that, it's making sure that, you know, not the entire school, but I made sure that, like, the pastoral team were aware of what was happening. I made sure that, you know, their form tutors were aware of what was happening. And when the young people engaged with it in a incredibly positive way, I made sure I rewarded them, and rewarding them, asking questions, answering questions, and just making sure that the classroom is kind of rooted in that atmosphere of respect, but also allowing, you know, genuine questions to be asked. And if questions weren't asked, challenging them. You know, I remember, you know, one of my students was from a specific demographic and a specific background that found it quite difficult. So they were given the space of explaining why. And equally, I was given the space to explain why we're going to be learning this and why it's important. And I'd like to believe that that particular student who, you know, at first, you know, had quite a lot of resistance towards it was marvelous. And also, you've got to remember that they're young people. So sometimes, even when young people are, you know, expressing what can be really, really, you know, painful things, that can be internalized homophobia. It can be internalized racism. So making sure that you are speaking to the necessary the necessary people in your school to support that as well. Of course, on the one hand, there are sanctions you follow, but equally, there's education that they need to have. There are misconceptions that need to be addressed. So I don't know if I've answered it. But
No, definitely. You've answered it and more, Josh. I mean, it's just so interesting. We don't have loads of time left, unfortunately, and I've got so many more questions. I think we could almost talk all night. I think we'll go to one final ad break and come back, and we've got a few questions. If anybody's got any questions for Josh, we've got about sort of 15 minutes for you to get in. But let's go to one more sort of message from our sponsors. We'll come back and finish this off.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by Teachwell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Cool, and we're back.
Yep.
Josh is back. Yep, there he is. A question for you just about yourself. You're obviously, you know, and it's coming across, incredibly passionate about these aspects. As a teacher from a minority background, do you sometimes feel there's a lot of pressure on you, you know, to really take these things on and drive things forward? I mean, even with the passion you have, do you sometimes feel that there is, you know, almost more expectation of yourself as a teacher, or you don't really feel that?
I don't know if I necessarily feel that there's more expectation on me as a teacher, but what I do feel is that, and this is the part that's hard, it's not only me, you know, like we're never going to achieve something if you only rely on, you know, people from those specific backgrounds to discuss it. So moving slightly away from history, but it'll make sense. Anti-racism, for example, anti-racism is a really, really important thing, but it can't be something that's just championed and pioneered by the Black teachers or the Asian teachers or the teachers of color. It has to be something that's championed and pioneered by everyone. And I think when looking at history, these kinds of histories, once again, it can't be something that is just championed and pioneered by teachers of color. You know, you can't solely rely on Asian teachers to teach Asian history. It has to be something that all of us kind of, and maybe I'm being idealistic, but it's something that all of us have to take on. So I think on the one hand, if there is a frustration, it might be that. I think equally, you know, I absolutely love talking about decolonization and Black history and stuff like that. And you guys don't do it because, you know, you've got so many teachers of color talking about other subjects, but it's equally recognizing that, you know, teachers have so many talents. They may talk about teaching and learning. Behavior might be something that they're good at. Assessment, I know, leadership, for example. And it's just, for me, it's more being conscious of making sure that people of color are included in the other conversations around any kind of thing, and making sure that it becomes it becomes a concern of us all. Pressure, I don't necessarily feel the pressure, because for me, I make mistakes all the time. You know, teaching's a vocation that you're not going to get right all the time. You know, and if you do it long enough, you're going to make mistakes upon mistakes upon mistakes. And the thing that's quite difficult about teaching is quite often you make those mistakes in front of young people. you know, and in front of all kinds of people. But you go back and you try again and you learn. So no, I don't feel the pressure, because I recognize that I'm going to make mistakes. I'm not always going to get it right. But equally, I do it for the young people. So hopefully, when I am trying to do something, the message gets across and it allows them to develop. It allows them to learn and it allows them to become better human beings and better historians.
Yeah. And like, you know, it's obviously something I hope that is interesting to people who are listening tonight or are going to listen later. And in terms of like inspiring them to maybe think about their own curriculum. So if there's a teacher out there who is thinking about starting with teaching, say African kingdoms, for instance, but has no idea where to start or what to do, what would be your advice to them?
I'm not allowed to plug any books, am I?
you can plug some books. Like, well, if I was like, okay, the book, one of the best books to start on, if I'm like, I really know nothing, but I'm so interested in doing something. Like, yeah, of course. Like, where would you say, you know, they should start?
Cool, don't crucify me here. I'd plug OUP's African Kingdoms of West Africa by Katie Emery and Tenny Gogov. I'll definitely say, you know, that is a good place to start, because, you know, they have put a considerable amount of effort into creating that book. I think that's a really, really, really good place to start. Dan Linden also wrote a book. It's on the Black History series, and it's called African Empires. And then finally, teaching history has a number of articles that you can read. We at the moment, because we were learning about Notting Hill, we've been looking at Small Acts by the BBC as well. That looks more at Black British history post 1945. So these are all, you know, the kind of places you can go. I'm sure there's podcasts, there's a podcast called, I think it's called It's a Continent, that they go through the story, the history of countries in the continent one by one. So that's really good. So yeah, these are some of the places where you can find out about more of this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in terms of a time period, what would you sort of recommend? Like, what you're talking about is a massive scope of history, isn't it? So where are you sort of locating that time frame in terms of teaching of African kingdoms?
Well, look, it depends on what you wanted to do. So we usually look at the medieval period. So from about like from the medieval period maybe to the industrial period. So like from about, you know, from about like the 1400s roughly. But it depends on what you're trying to do. So for example, if your focus is maybe more on the presence and the migration of Black people in Britain, you might start from, you know, 43 AD when, you know, the Romans came under Claudius. That's where you might start. Or if you're looking at the transatlantic slave trade, for example, you might start in the medieval period with the African kingdoms. You might, for example, look at Mansa Musa. Mansa Musa is also always a great place to start. There's a lot of information about him, but I must warn, and this is, you know, shout out to my good friend Otis, you can't Mansa Musa your way to a decolonized curriculum. But, you know,
Mansa Musa. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what do you mean by that? That's an interesting comment.
It's coined by my friend, really. And, you know, I think post kind of 2022, you know, a lot of information about Mansa Musa became available. And so a lot of teachers have included Mansa Musa in their curriculum, which is great. I did it as well. But that's not the only person, and that's not the only story. It takes far more kind of far more conscientious kind of reading and research and looking at those other figures, because Mansa Musa is great, but for some people that creates challenges in and of itself, you know, because Mansa Musa is still kind of an imperial figure. And I think it's Kehinde Andrews argues that, you know, in many ways, Mansa Musa still kind of exploited the people in the Kingdom of Mali to produce, you know, a lot of that gold for him. So it's complicated. But to simplify it a little bit, medieval African kingdoms from, you know, the 1400s give a great platform, because there's a lot of information around them.
Yeah, I was going to, like, I've got a sort of a big question to sort of finish off on. But just when you're talking of Mansa Musa, do you see the same issues? I mean, my understanding of, I say, GCSE are even lower in terms of the curriculum because I only teach A level. But I do see it even with my daughter's education is the same issues with Mary Seacombe. Like it's like one of the only sort of black figures they learn about. And in that sense, it's like, you know, here's sort of another person, but it's almost like not even a bigger or wider story. It's like, we're going to do this as a, you know, one story, and then we've sort of ticked the box and move on. Do you see the same sort of issues, or is it getting better with Mary Seacombe? Because that was always my sort of feeling, that it was like sort of almost jammed in as a tick box exercise for, you know, for schools to say, yeah, we've studied one black person.
100%. And I think when Otis made that statement, I think that's what he was saying. And that's it, really. You can't just, yeah, you know what, we've put Mansa Musa in the curriculum, so we've done it. No, you know, you can't. And if anything, that can be a bit more dangerous than helpful. So no, it can't just be, as you said, looking at Mary Seacole during the Crimean War or Mansa Musa during, you know, the Mali Kingdom. It has to be a lot more than that. It's the thing about decolonization is it's a never-ending process. You're constantly reflecting and refining, and that's the same case too about these kinds of histories. You're constantly reflecting, you're constantly refining, you're constantly finding different stories to reach your young people, because nobody's curriculum just stays exactly the same, like, you know, for 10 years. Your curriculum is it's breathing, it's living, it grows, it develops, you know. And what might have been, you know, what might have been, I guess, appropriate for a particular year group, you might say, okay, this isn't kind of the story that reaches another year group. So you've got to always kind of evolve with it. So yeah, you can't just have that one Mansa Musa story, that one Mary Seacole story, and think, okay, my job is done. You know, you can't have the one John Blank story as well. You know, it's, you've got to make sure that you're consistently telling stories throughout.
Yeah. So big question to finish. Well, I think it's a pretty difficult question, but you tell me. I'm looking in front of me on my desk. I've got the Black Curriculum, the Black British History in the National Curriculum Report from 2020, authored by Jason Arde. And in that, they recommend that Black British History should be mandatory. And I just thought, I know it's a big question, but to end on, what are your thoughts? Should it be mandatory, or should it? Would it be better for teachers to come to it themselves?
I've thought about, so my view on it is this, really. I think sometimes you've got to be careful what you ask for, and that's you can make Black History mandatory, but then what might happen is you might start getting a lot of bad Black History being taught. I think before you get to that place where Black History is mandatory, in a similar way to you know, the Center of Excellence around the Holocaust, you need a similar thing for the teaching of migration, empire, and people, a similar thing for Black British History, a kind of institution that's focused on producing resources, that's focused on delivering the best class CPD, so that teachers are well equipped to deliver this kind of history. Because I don't think there's much resistance towards teaching this history. I think it's more about, like you say, the how. So I think it's far more important to make sure teachers are equipped with the how. And once you've got these kind of organizations put in place that are well-funded, that are well-resourced, then you might ask that question about making it mandatory. But I think to start off with is making sure that it's taught properly and teachers are supported in it being taught properly.
Yeah, well, that's a really, really interesting answer, Josh. Look, I mean, we've gone 90 minutes and I haven't asked half the questions I wanted to. I've got a huge list of stuff. I mean, I think that just shows, you know, how interesting your answers have been and everything you sort of provided has been, I think, just so eye-opening. I can't thank you enough. It's been such a great conversation in terms of teaching me a lot as well. And it's not something, you know, that I've sort of engaged in much in my own teaching. So yeah, thanks so much, Josh. I really, really appreciate it. And yeah, your expertise is so appreciated tonight.
No. Once again, thank you for inviting me on. Don't know much, but I hope I shared something. And yeah, you know, hopefully we can have more conversations about this and other topics going forward. But, you know, really happy to be on your first show. And, you know, I think you did a cracking job yourself. It was really fun talking to you.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking one of the big problems is how do I follow this up, you know, next month? This is my first show and you've been an amazing guest. Thanks so much, Josh. Hopefully we'll catch up, actually, you know, not just online in the future sometime soon. Yeah, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And to everybody listening at home, thanks so much.
Okay, take care. Thank you.
All right. Cheers, Josh.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.